It's just the medication, I tell myself, eating through my stomach. It can't possibly have anything to do with Eliza being back. I think about Mr. Hines and the Punnett Squares, dominant and recessive traits. But where this fucking mental illness comes from, I have no idea. No one else in my family is crazy like I am. I'm the defective one, the mistake. And I am obviously not fit for survival. If I were out in the wild, I would have been left for dead long ago. I curl up as small as possible on the floor and wait for the nausea to pass. 8. The library at Stanyan Hill is pretty unimpressive for a private school. It's about the size of 2 classrooms put together, the shelves filled with big reference volumes no one ever looks at, and a whole lot of paperback teen fiction like the Twilight series. There are a few classics and some oversized collections of poetry and short stories. And then there is a whole wall of different magazines. My mom has been fighting for years to get them to expand the library, or at least to expand their collection, but it's never been a priority. From what I've seen, the library is just kind of an afterthought. The school spent all this money building a big fancy computer lab and stocking it full of brand new Macs, so barely anyone even uses the library anymore. In a lot of ways, I'm surprised my mom still has a job here. The library is pretty much empty every time I go in. And today at lunch is no exception. The door is propped open, and my mom is sitting on a stool behind the desk, reading a book herself. There are a couple of freshmen reading a graphic novel together at one of the round wooden tables in the corner by the window. They are very small and very young-looking, with pasty, pale skin. They have on preppy sweaters and loose-fitting jeans and white old man sneakers. They are dorks. They part their hair on the sides. They hang out in the library during lunch. But then again, so do I. "Hey, Mom," I say, startling her from whatever book she's reading. "Shh," she tells me, holding a finger up. She's wearing a thick wool sweater and a knit scarf and her librarian glasses. Her hair is cut a few inches above her shoulders. I look over at the 2 nerdy freshmen again and raise my shoulder up like, "Seriously? I have to be quiet for these guys?" She follows my gaze and then smiles and gestures for me to go back into her office. I follow her along the thick carpeting that still smells new all throughout this floor of the school. Her office is small, about the size of a closet, with a desk and no computer, and a couch my mom brought in herself from Goodwill. She has pictures of me and Jane and Dad up on the wall. There are even a couple pictures of our cat, Mishkin. But there are no pictures of Teddy, just as there are no pictures of Teddy in our house. I can't blame her. Remembering is painful. But pictures are no pictures. I'm sure he's with her every second, the way he is with me. His picture is projected there on the backs of our eyelids, so we don't need it hanging in a frame. I take a seat on the shiny upholstery, and the springs whine and buckle beneath my not very substantial frame. My mom sits in her broken office chair that's been stuck in the lowest position to the ground, so she appears very short, even though she's a whole inch taller than I am. "Here you go," she says, handing me a plastic-wrapped peanut butter sandwich and a small, roughly textured apple. "Would you like some coffee?" The lines and creases around her mouth are deep set, so that when she purses her lips together, it gives the appearance of a dried-up piece of fruit. I nod yes. She pours black, bitter-smelling coffee from out of the large stainless steel thermos into a metal camping mug and passes it over. I take a bite of the sandwich made on processed wheat bread with strawberry jelly that leaks out the side. I wipe my mouth on the sleeve of my undershirt. "Thanks," I say. She drinks her coffee but does not eat. "Mom?" I start hesitantly, looking down at the scuffed-up toes of my boots. "Mom, did you know Eliza Lindbergh was back in school?" My mom freezes up, the coffee mug held just inches from her open mouth. "No, I didn't." She completes the sip of coffee, and I take a bite of sandwich, talking with my mouth full. "Yeah, I saw her. I guess they're back from opening that restaurant in New Orleans." My mom sets the coffee down and leans forward, intertwining her fingers on her crossed knees. Her eyes narrow behind her horn-rimmed glasses. "Miles, I promise, I had no idea. I would have told you. No, no, I know. I didn't mean it like that. Well, are you going to be okay? Have you talked to her yet? No, I haven't. But, yeah, of course I'll be all right. It's just weird, is all. My mother stares like she's trying to see something hidden inside me. I stay quiet. Well, just be careful, Miles. I laugh then at that, though of course I know she's right. Even before Eliza rejected me straight out, I was always getting messed up about her. There was this one time when we were on a class ski trip that all us kids were playing truth or dare up in the girls' bunks in the lodge. Someone dared Eliza to kiss me, and she acted like just the thought of it was the most disgusting thing in the world. She told everyone it made her want to barf. So she never did kiss me on the dare, and I was so crushed. Like my insides had all been torn out of me. But then, the next day when we found ourselves alone on the ski slope, she came up to me and kissed me very quickly on the mouth. She whispered that she was just completing her dare. Then she skied off. And of course, I was fucking elated. It's lame to say it like that, I guess. But I don't care. I was elated. And I thought for sure it meant she liked me. Of course, it wasn't too long after that she was back being mean to me in front of everyone again. Yeah, I say. I mean, no. You're right. My mom sits up a little straighter. She takes a sip of her coffee and then leans forward even closer this time. I'm serious, Miles. Yeah, so am I tell her. I look up at my mom's weathered face. You don't have to worry. I take another bite of sandwich. That is the truth, only I don't know how to explain it to my mom so she'll understand. How could I ever let myself get involved in any kind of romantic relationship when Teddy is still out there missing, and it is my fault? How could I ever let myself have any kind of happiness? No, until Teddy is found, I'll never be able to move on with my own life. None of us will. Our whole family is trapped in a state of perpetual suspended animation. We are frozen, waiting. And what will save us? What will allow us to start living again? Finding Teddy. That is all. My mom sips her coffee, and that's when it hits me. Something has to be done, and I think for the first time that I'm the one who has to do it. Teddy is out there. It's up to me to bring him home. There's a voice whispering through my mind, like sunlight shining in, like the ocean swelling around me, like the world has broken wide open and I am standing at the very center of the universe. I am the one. I have to find him. And I will. 9. Our junior class is a lot bigger than our grade school class used to be, but it's still super small compared with most high schools, and there really isn't any way to avoid running into someone you don't want to see. Inexplicably, though, I managed to make it through 2 whole days before seeing Eliza again. But today we're having a whole school assembly, so I know I won't be able to avoid it. We all file in together to the newly remodeled auditorium. I sit next to Preston and Jackie, but they're busy looking meaningfully into each other's eyes, so they don't even seem to notice me as I scan the room, looking for Eliza. And then I see her. She walks in by herself. Her hair is even darker than I remember, black and full and layered. She's wearing ripped jeans tucked into calf-length boots, a gray cardigan sweater, and a loose-fitting t-shirt. She is tall and thin and beautiful. I watch as she takes a seat at the front, seemingly oblivious to the rest of the herd moving past her. Preston leans in close to me. Dude, stare much? I'm startled a little by his sudden attention. What? I'm not staring at anyone. He laughs. Yeah, right. I breathe and hold the air in my lungs before exhaling all at once as I ask him, Well, have you talked to her? Yeah, he says, averting his eyes. I did real quick. Sorry, man, I couldn't help it. My stomach knots up, and I keep glancing down at the place where Eliza is sitting. It really does seem like the more you try not to think about something, the more that ends up being the only fucking thing you can think about. That's the way it is with Eliza. In spite of myself and all my intentions, I can't help but want to know. Did she ask about me? Preston coughs and looks over at Jackie. Yeah, a little. What did she say? I don't know, man. She asked about you.
Really?
Yeah, it seems like she maybe wants to apologize or something. Like she realized how fucked up she was being to you.
Great, I think. So she feels sorry for me. That's exactly what I fucking need.
But what I say is, no, man, she doesn't need to do that.
Preston shakes his head.
Hell yes, she does. But if I were you, I might give it some time. I don't want anything, you know, bad to happen. There's a heat swelling in my brain. I wish that everyone would stop worrying about me. I'm not some total invalid. But what I say is,
of course, man, forget it. I really don't care.
He laughs then.
Sure.
I don't, I tell him. I've got more important things to do than worry about Eliza Lindbergh.
Yeah? Like what?
He asks.
I just...
What?
I...
But I don't try to explain. I can't tell Preston what I'm planning to do. What I've been chosen to do. I can't tell anyone. They wouldn't understand. They'd tell me I was wasting my time. That I was getting in over my head. That I was being stupid, naive, and whatever else. And hell, maybe I am. But it doesn't matter.
Preston smiles again as he says, Well, anyway, that party I'm having Saturday night? Eliza told me she's gonna be there. And,
He pauses, looking back at Jackie, before continuing on.
She did say she wanted to see you.
My face goes flush then. And there's this tightening in my stomach.
She wants to see me?
Preston nods slowly.
So that means you're coming then, huh?
I force myself to breathe.
No, man, I told you, I don't care about Eliza.
So you're not coming?
I don't know, man. I'll see.
He leans over to Jackie.
He's totally coming.
She laughs, her white teeth flashing.
Please come, she says to me. At least I'll have someone to talk to. I hate his big parties.
Me too, I tell her. Preston sets his jaw, then clicks it back and forth.
Well, no one's forcing you all.
Jackie kisses him quickly on the cheek.
No, I'll be there. You should come too, Miles. We can hide out in Press's room together.
I nod, suddenly distracted, listening to the mass of students talking at once, the sound like the steady vibrating hum of a working beehive, growing ever louder, as though someone has come along and shaken the thing up, the drone swarming, agitated, driven blindly by some unknown desire. And there is Eliza. She's sitting there silently, in the very center, as if it were all for her. And so I tell myself again that finding Teddy is all that matters. Preston's party, Jackie, Eliza, goddamn school assemblies, the swarming hive, none of it matters. It is all meaningless.
Anyway, Jackie continues, there'll be so many people, you probably won't even see Eliza.
Yeah, that's true. Our school principal, Miss Brizendine, steps up behind the podium on the stage. The noise of the swarm starts to quiet down around us. Eliza sits very still, and I try not to notice.
10.
If there's one thing I've learned from watching all those film noirs with my mom, is that detectives always begin by interviewing the primary witness. And in this instance, Dottie Peterson is not just the primary witness. She is the only witness. The one who told the police she saw Teddy getting into that truck. I've never actually met Dottie Peterson myself, considering I was in the hospital the first 72 hours after Teddy's disappearance. But her name, along with the town she lived in, was printed in pretty near every article there was on the kidnapping at that time. So finding her these 2 years later was actually super easy. All I had to do was call information. She was listed as D. Peterson of Burlingame, California. The operator connected me, and Dottie answered on the second ring. Of course, I was nervous as hell, calling her like that, my voice shaking all over the place as I tried to explain who I was and what I wanted. But she was very nice and very patient. She even agreed to let me go to her house to talk about Teddy and to have, as she put it, a good chat. She told me several times how sorry she was for me. She really was very nice. It's only a short bus ride down to Burlingame, so after work,
I go to catch the Muni over on 19th Avenue. It takes a while for the bus to get here, but I finally see it coming through the fog, rattling loudly, then stopping with a hiss of its brakes. The bus driver, a tall, heavily built man with a gray, coarse-looking beard, glances without interest at my bus pass. The whole bus is pretty near empty. There's a man wearing a tattered corduroy three-piece suit that looks at least 30 years old. That is, the suit looks that old. The man looks much older. He rubs his chin with his thumb and forefinger over and over and seems to be speaking silently to himself, repeating words like he repeats the motion of his fingers. Another man, also in his 50s or even 60s, I'd say, with a big white beard and his hair slicked back, stares straight down at his own hands, which are twisting and tightening around themselves. There is a small woman with a thick down jacket and a clear plastic bag covering her hair, presumably to protect it from the moisture in the air outside. I sit at the back on the hard plastic seat and take out the book I'm supposed to be reading for school, Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. It's a big fucking thing to carry around, but I don't mind because I really do love it, only right now I can't seem to focus. My eyes are blurred, my thoughts scattered. I read three whole pages before I realize I haven't remembered or comprehended a thing. Outside, along the rows of white two-story Victorian houses, the soft glow of Christmas tree lights blurs past in the front bay windows. The sidewalks are deserted, though there's a steady stream of traffic on the street. The bus lurches and stops, and the driver honks impatiently at a truck stalled in our lane. There are well-fed but idle-looking black crows lazily grooming themselves, perched high up on the dead trees in the center island. The crows line the telephone wires, the rain gutters, and the rooftops. Crows everywhere. Again. Always. Forever reminding me that I'm on the edge, teetering, fighting to hold on to the real through the unreal. Teddy. He is what's real. My 9-year-old brother, out there somewhere, terrified and alone. Finding him is all that matters. I watch the fog beginning to dissipate as we climb out of the avenues, turning right past San Francisco State, merging onto the 101 freeway. It ends up taking about half an hour to get to the bus stop closest to where Dottie Peterson lives. Burlingame is all suburban developments and strip malls and wholesale markets. The sky is clear and cold. I pull my hood down low over my eyes, walking up a residential street of rundown houses, mostly surrounded by chain-link fencing and rock gardens. A blue-gray, shaggy, medium-sized dog comes running up from one of the yards. His bark is high-pitched as he jumps at the fence. A few cars drive slowly past. There's a pair of ragged-looking squirrels chasing each other up a barren fruit tree. The blue-gray dog notices the squirrels and goes off after them, spinning in little circles at the corner of the fence. It barks and barks. The squirrels, for their part, stop chasing each other and begin taunting the luckless dog. I move off down the block. The wind blows stronger, so there are bits of trash. Old newspapers, coffee cups, McDonald's wrappers, and plastic bags carried out into the street. One solitary black crow seems to be hanging, motionless, in midair above me, one leg tucked up to its belly, the claw curled like a tiny fist. I struggle to get a cigarette lit. There's a bunch of giant blow-up Christmas decorations in the yard of a house built around a metal trailer. A generator groans ineffectually as the plastic Santa falls limp to one side and begins flapping like a flag in the wind. An equally unimpressive snow globe is bent in half, crushing the back hoof of one of the flattened reindeer. The next house has a fake chimney propped atop its shingled roof, with plastic Santa's legs sticking straight up, as though he were actively sliding headfirst into their fireplace. There's a sign, made up of colored lights just below it, wishing the entire neighborhood a Merry Christmas. The holidays are still over 3 weeks away, but nearly every house on the block is decorated. At home, we haven't gotten a tree yet, or put up any lights or anything. We've barely celebrated Christmas at all these last 2 years. Jane gets excited about it, naturally, and we pitch in to get her presents and watch Christmas movies and take her ice skating at the Embarcadero. But how could any of us ever be truly happy knowing that my brother is out there somewhere, terrified, alone? That is why I'm here. And I will not stop till I find him. 11. Dottie Peterson's house is even smaller than ours, all dark paneling, with a wall of built-in bookshelves, stacked unevenly with paperback novels like you'd buy in a grocery store. There are also at least 5 or 6 cats roaming around the apartment, and way more cat furniture, those complicated, carpeted, always dirty-looking geometric structures, than people furniture. The cats are scraggly. They keep alternating between scratching themselves and pouncing on one another, fighting and squabbling. The smell of cat piss burns like ammonia at the back of my throat. But Dottie is very nice, just like she was on the phone. She makes me Lipton tea in a small porcelain cup, with cats printed on it, naturally. We sit together on a deeply sagging couch, the brown corduroy upholstery torn from countless cat's claws. She's a large woman, with a sagging chin and neck hanging down. Her glasses are square and thick, so her narrow eyes are strangely magnified. She has short, dark, graying hair. Various cats jump on and off her lap as we talk. "You poor dear," she says to me, alternately sipping her own cup of tea and eating from a tin of butter cookies on the coffee table. "I wish there was more I could do to help. I suppose you've talked to that Detective Marshall. He struck me as a capable man." "No, not yet," I answer. Though, of course, I recognize the name as the primary detective in charge of Teddy's case. Dottie sits up straighter, smiling, as though she is actually quite excited by all this. It makes sense, I guess. She must be lonely here in this dark little house. I mean, maybe she has a husband or a girlfriend or something, but I kind of doubt it. "Well, you should go talk to him. I imagine he'll tell you whatever you want to know. Why, I still have the business card he gave me on my refrigerator, I believe."
"From 2 years ago?"
"Certainly. It was such an exciting, I mean, terrible tragedy. But I'm sure Detective Marshall will make time for you. It's just, they're so busy, you know, the police up in San Francisco. A case like your brother's, well, they usually accept whatever answer is the easiest. An open case looks bad for the department. I learned that watching Law and Order. It's so good. Have you seen it? I love that Jack McCoy."
She gestures toward the flat-screen TV, which looks strangely out of place in this falling-apart living room that practically has mold growing out of the corners. "No, I haven't."
"Well, never mind. The point is, the police don't like having unsolved cases on their books. That's why they insist that Teddy, your brother, must have drowned. Even though I've told them over and over again what I saw, they refuse to believe it because they want everything neat and tidy, wrapped up with a little bow on it. You know what I mean?"
"So you don't think he drowned?"
Her hand reaches out and grabs mine suddenly. The feel of it is warm and sticky, so I want to pull away. But I don't want to be impolite. "I know he didn't," she tells me, looking straight into my eyes. "And you're right to do this on your own."
I laugh awkwardly. "Really? I thought maybe I was being crazy."
"Not at all, not at all. The police can only do so much in these kinds of situations. They have limited time, and limited resources, too. You see, both my parents were killed by a hit-and-run driver when my sisters and I were little girls."
She's still holding my hand and staring straight at me, and I see her eyes start to redden with tears.
"The police did what they could, of course, but they never found the driver."
"Jesus," I say. Her hand loosens its grip on mine, and she bows her head.
"Yes, well, we all have our crosses to bear. That's why, when I heard about what happened at the beach that day, I made up my mind to come forward and tell the police what I'd seen. In fact,"
she breaks off, glancing at me quickly, her whole face turning a deep purple color as she blushes all down her neck.
I'm sorry,"
she falters.
I don't know how to say this to you, but it's my fault. All of it. I knew it was going to happen."
Trembling, she takes up some tissues from a box on the end table and dabs at her eyes.
What do you mean? You couldn't have known.
Oh, she says. Oh, God, forgive me. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
She lurches across the empty space between us, and before I can react, I find myself with my head pressed firmly against her ample fucking bosom, covered mercifully by a gray sweatshirt with, of course, cats printed on it. She begins to cry then, holding me against her like that, and I wonder if maybe I'm not the only one who forgot to take their medication today.
But you didn't know, I say, desperately trying to pull myself away.
You shouldn't blame yourself. I mean, if anyone's to blame, it's me, not you.
Oh, that's sweet of you, she tells me, drying her eyes. That's very kind of you. If only you knew how I've been torturing myself, day in and day out.
Yeah, me too, I think, but don't say out loud.
You see,
she continues,
I hadn't meant to go to the beach at all. Only it was so hot, and you know I work as a toll booth operator at the bridge. I decided to stop off on my way home. Of course, I'm not one for swimming or sunbathing, but I like watching the ocean. I sat at one of the picnic tables.
Picnic tables? My mind turns that around, trying to remember. Where are their picnic tables? She smiles.
Why, just at the parking lot. I was sitting at the picnic tables, looking out at the ocean. I noticed the waves were getting bigger and bigger, and then a group of kids went running past me. They went up to play in the sand dunes, so when I saw your brother, at first I thought he must have come from that group of children.
And you're sure? I ask hurriedly. You're sure it was Teddy? My words falter, trying to pronounce his name. The backs of my eyes are burning now, imagining the beach, the waves, the sand dunes, the group of kids playing, and Teddy there with me, until I left him alone.
I know it was him,
she answers. Her hand takes mine up again, and this time I don't mind.
The police showed me dozens of photos. I spoke with your mom and dad. I remember them perfectly. They were such lovely people. And yes, again, to answer your question, I am 100% sure. It was him. Red hair, freckles, about this tall.
She shows me with her free hand, holding it about her shoulder height from the ground. What was he doing? I stammer.
He was walking by himself, and then a man came over and began talking to him. I couldn't hear what they were saying. The boy shook his head. I told the police that afterward. He shook his head twice, and then the man took him by the arm and led him into that car.
A white Ford Explorer, I say. The tears coming now, so I can't fight them.
That's right, she tells me, looking straight at me again. That's right. And I knew. At the time, I knew. Something was not right. That's why I remembered it all as clearly as I did. Because I knew that something was wrong. And I did nothing. In my heart, I felt it. I felt like I should stop that man from taking that child. But I didn't act. I failed. It is my fault.
She cries then, too. And we cry together. And the man? I blurt out louder than I mean to, my voice cracking. The man? Her head drops, and she clasps her hands together, releasing me.
He was a tall man, balding on top, gray hair around the sides. He had a large nose and was wearing loose sweatpants and a sweatshirt. His face was hard, sunken in, no meat on his bones at all. But it was his eyes that stayed with me. His eyes were like...
She stares off then, waving her arm absently in front of her, as though trying to catch the words out of the air.
Like a black hole, she finally says. Like emptiness.
I shiver, pulling my jacket tighter around me. Did he struggle? I ask timidly. She shakes her head again.
No, it wasn't like that. He just went with the man. They talked, and then they got in the car together.
I nod. She takes her cup up off the table and brings it to her mouth,
but then replaces it without drinking.
"When you called me," she says, "I started thinking about what I should tell you, and I believe I received a sort of testimony, you understand? That I should share with you the answer, the real answer, to the only question there truly can be for anyone."
My breath catches. "Yes, no, I mean, you've already helped me so much. I don't know how to thank you." I start trying to get myself up as if to go, but she just smiles, tapping my knee a few times, as though gently hammering me into the sofa.
"You don't need to thank me. Something brought us together today. Something bigger than you or me."
"Uh-huh," I say dumbly.
"Do you know who can get you through this?"
she asks, purring almost like one of her cats.
"Do you know who you can rely on? Who your family can rely on? Who will save you? And who will save your brother?"
My head bobs up and down mechanically. I know what's coming, but there's nothing much I can do about it now.
"Jesus Christ," she says, not waiting for my answer. "Jesus Christ died on the cross to give us all everlasting life and take away our sins. Jesus is with you, always. He is with us all, always. We can either reject him, going it alone, or we can take him into our hearts, and he will guide us to our rightful place in the kingdom of heaven."
I nod and smile, like a damn idiot, then get up from the couch. "Yes, well," I say. "Thank you, but I really do have to get back. I'll let you know if I find anything." She adjusts the glasses on her porcine nose and pushes herself up to standing.
"But I'm not done. There's so much more I have to tell you."
She stares up at me, her eyes wet and red and pleading. And then suddenly I can see. I can see why she was so eager to have me come down here today. I can see why she gave interviews to every paper and appeared on every news report about the kidnapping. I can see why she remembers it all as clearly as she does. I can see why she has Detective Marshall's business card on her refrigerator over 2 years later. And I can see why she continues to blame herself for not having stopped that man from taking Teddy. She wants to be a part of the story. It's as simple as that. She lives alone here. She works collecting tolls at the bridge. She has her cats, her church, her TV shows. Witnessing Teddy's kidnapping must have made her feel, maybe for the first time ever, truly important. So of course she would think that God had some greater purpose in letting my brother get taken like that. Because for her, the greater purpose was that she finally got to be somebody. They put her picture in the paper. She got to be on TV. Not just once, but many times. "I have to go," I say. "I'm sorry." I start toward the door.
"No, wait!"
Her hand reaches out, as if to stop me. But I don't stop. I keep on going. I open the door. And I don't turn back. 12. By the time I get home, my mom and dad are out at a movie with Janie, so I'm left on my own for dinner. But in all my nervousness and whatever, I find that I'm really not hungry. I'm going crazy sitting here by myself, so I finally decide, like, fuck it. I might as well go to Preston's party. I clean myself up as much as possible and put on what I would consider my coolest clothes. Just a pair of jeans and a ripped-up t-shirt over a thermal undershirt, and a big fur-lined army jacket, because it's freezing outside. Of course, I know it's fucking stupid to be going to this thing, but I go on anyway, walking down the avenues for a couple of blocks, crossing over Lake Street and heading up into Seacliff, where every house is the size of a fucking castle, and no lights are ever on in any of the windows, and no music is ever heard on the street. People here are so rich, they're able to shut the world out completely, and to shut themselves out from the world. In our neighborhood, at least, people yell and laugh and fight and burn things and have dead chickens hanging in their storefront windows. Here it's all imitation Italian villas, and imitation French chateaus, and imitation Bavarian estates, and imitation Spanish whatever you call them, and imitation Japanese-style houses like Eliza used to live in. It's funny how rich people like to pretend so much. Rich people are like little kids, like Teddy used to be, with his toy cars and action figures, and the Superman cape he made out of a bathroom towel. With enough money, they can be anything they want to be. I remember Eliza's dad wanted to be a kind of samurai sushi chef, which is why they had that house like some Shinto temple. Preston's parents want to be crazy bohemians traveling all over the world, and they can do it too, because they have the money. They can be whatever they want to be, while the rest of us are stuck being what we are. I begin to see cars parked up and down the street, cars that must belong to people attending Preston's party, lining the golf course and filling the upper parking lot of the Palace of the Legion of Honor. Preston's always been super popular, and even though I know for sure none of these people are anywhere near as close to him as I am, I can't help but feel a little jealous, or just annoyed maybe, because it's not like any of these kids actually give a shit about him. Not really. All they care about is the fact that he has a nice house, and his parents are never around. The house is nice, though, it's true. Built alone on the jagged cliffs, surrounded by cypress trees and low-hanging fog, with a Gothic-style pitched roof and marble columns and all sorts of stained-glass windows and skylights. I go into the front gate, and there are some upperclassmen hanging out around the fountain, smoking a blunt, I think, and I wave to them meekly. They don't wave back or acknowledge me, and I think maybe I should turn around. I mean, really, I hate parties, and I'm not sure what the hell I'm even doing here. It's strange to be with kids my age, trying so hard to be cool and fucking popular, especially when I just came from meeting with that woman who actually witnessed my brother being kidnapped. The way she described that man, it's so terrible to think about. And yet she still tried to tell me that there is some kind of God looking out for us, protecting us even. Can that really be the way it works? I mean, I'm not saying I don't believe in God. I really do like the idea of some higher power like that. But I don't think it has anything to do with my brother being taken by some psycho, or these jackasses standing around smoking weed. Looking at these kids standing in their designer fucking clothes, smoking their designer fucking pot, I can't help feeling like I want to tear the whole world apart. It was a mistake to come. I can see that immediately. I should leave. Only, Preston did say that Eliza was going to be here. Not that it matters. What matters is finding Teddy. What matters is bringing my family back together. Eliza doesn't matter at all. But my heart beats painfully fast just thinking about her. The idea of seeing her again is almost more than I can stand. My hands shake as I hold them out in front of me. Past those boys smoking the blunt, past the fountain and the statues, and the marble staircase and the front door, Eliza is there. Or at least she's supposed to be. And Preston says she wants to see me, to talk to me, to apologize. Over 2 years have gone by, and so much has changed. I ring the buzzer. 13. Inside, the music is loud, so Preston has to shout, "Yo, Miles, what's up?" He has on this crazy knit hat that's like all these different colors of yarn stitched together. "Come on in, man," he says. We walk in through the front entrance and up the stairs, past the rows of framed photographs of Preston and his mom and dad. Tonight, since they're not home, we have free range of the entire house. We keep on walking up to the main dining room and kitchen, where I see maybe 100 kids hanging out. "Damn, there are so many people here," I tell him, dragging hard on my cigarette. He laughs. "Hell yeah, there are. I told everyone to invite as many friends as they wanted. This is gonna be the party of the century." He leads me through the throngs of people dancing and whatever, while the rapper dude on the stereo is singing, "Shake your ass, watch yourself, shake your ass, show me what you're working with." "Is this really happening right now?" I whisper to him. But I know the answer, and anyway, he doesn't hear me. On the little center island in the kitchen are a bunch of bottles of different hard liquors and orange juice and stuff, and the music is so loud, and there are all these bodies moving against mine. I suddenly feel that pain coming back in my stomach, and then I remember I didn't eat anything before taking my goddamn medication, so that must be why I'm getting so sick like this. Usually I try to space it out, But tonight, since I knew I was leaving, I took them all at the same time. The 4 tablets of lithium, the 3 capsules of Prozac, the 2 Lamictal, the 2 Zyprexa, the 2 Depakote, and the 1 Abilify. And so they're burning like an oil fire through the lining of my intestines.
Hey! I yell. Hey, do you have anything to eat here, man? I'm sorry.
Preston hands me a drink in a red plastic cup, saying,
Here, shoot this dude, and you'll feel better.
I repeat my question, but he just keeps saying,
Shoot it!
And so I fucking do. And it burns going down. And I cough, and I feel it like more fire in my belly. I imagine it mixing together with all the undigested medication, forming this acid substance that eats through the lining of my stomach, and then comes spilling out through my skin right there onto the dark-colored tile.
Man, I'm serious. Do you have any food here I could eat?
Preston takes his shot and shakes his head and says real loud,
Blah! Yeah, sure, I think. Look in the fridge, man. You can have whatever. Cool, thanks.
I start walking over, but it's like that shot was injected straight into my bloodstream, because I feel dizzy and weak. I crush out my cigarette on the floor, because I can't stand the smell of it for one more second. Preston is gone now, and I'm all alone with these people moving together like some giant, pulsing organic life form crawling out of the primordial sea, taking its first steps on land, writhing and gyrating and secreting fluids. The electric lights seem to pulse and crackle with the sound of the bass thumping on the stereo. I close my eyes and reach out my hand and fall onto the tile. I retch some, but nothing comes out, thank God. Because then there's a voice, and it's calling out to me.
Miles?
Miles, are you okay? I open my eyes. I'm not sure if this is another hallucination or what, but she is there, crouching over me.
Miles, what's wrong?
She puts her hand on my forehead, and it feels so cool and calming somehow. I smell that old familiar smell of her, like shampoo and clean laundry, and I'm not sure what else.
Eliza?
I say. Is that you? She smiles brightly.
Yeah, of course.
She helps me to my feet.
Come on,
she says, her voice calming.
You want to go get some air?
I nod, and we walk together back outside. 14. The wind is blowing strong across the stone courtyard, and Eliza is shivering, so I give her my jacket.
You sure?
She asks, pulling it tighter around her shoulders.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just didn't eat enough. We can go back inside.
She shakes her head.
No, not yet. I want to talk to you, she says.
Her voice has gotten deeper somehow. Her black hair is pushed back behind her ears. I struggle for breath a little, but I'm trying to hold it together, so I light another cigarette, looking down into those shining green-blue eyes of hers. Hey, I'm taller than you, I say, smiling.
Yeah, I wonder when that happened.
She takes a step closer to me and turns, and I can see her profile. Her nose so delicate and sculptural. Her full lips. I think for the billionth time how goddamn beautiful she is.
Can I have one of those?
She asks, looking back at me.
Yeah, sure.
I hand her a cigarette, and then try to light it for her, but the wind's too strong, so she has to do it herself. Somehow that feels like a really big failure on my part.
I've missed you, Miles,
she says, handing back the lighter, and our eyes meet, and then dart away quickly.
Me too.
She sits down on the step and zips up my big army coat.
I've been wanting to see you.
I sit next to her, and I can feel the heat from her body.
Me too.
I keep repeating it like a goddamn idiot.
Me too, me too, me too.
Have you really? She asks, leaning against me.
Yeah, totally.
But there's an overpowering smell, like rotting flesh and something burning that seems to come up from the ground around me inexplicably, and I reel back.
I heard about what happened to you, she says plainly.
I move away from her, but not because of what she said.
It's just that the smell is almost gagging me. But she takes it the wrong way.
Oh, I'm sorry, she says. We don't have to talk about that.
No, no, it's okay. Sorry, it's just my stomach. She nods.
Are you on a lot of medication?
I try holding myself very still against the nausea. Yeah, I guess. She smiles sweetly.
Well, I understand. I know it's not the same thing, but I've been seeing a therapist too for a couple months now. And she wants me to go see, like, one of those psychopharma... whatever they're called?
Psychopharmacologists.
Exactly.
I drag on my cigarette, exhaling through my nose. What are you seeing them for? I ask. Are you depressed? And then I add quickly, that is, if you don't mind my asking.
She leans against me again, and I watch her fingers twitching as she ashes her cigarette over and over. No, I don't mind. It's nice to be able to finally talk about it with someone. None of my friends understand.
Yeah, none of mine do either.
Right? I missed you, Miles. Remember how much we used to talk on the phone and stuff?
Of course. Every night. My head is kind of spinning, so I rub my temple with the side of my thumb like I'm trying to put the world on pause.
So what happened? I ask hesitantly, not wanting to upset her too much by pushing the subject.
She breathes and smokes and breathes some more. Then she finally says,
You have to promise not to tell anyone else, okay?
I give her my promise. Believe me, I don't talk to anyone anyway. She laughs a little.
Well, the thing is, my dad left.
A cold sweat has broken out all up and down my body now because of the goddamn medication.
He met someone else, she says.
Jesus.
I know, right? The fucker. After all those years of fooling around and lying and everything, he finally just told my mom straight out he didn't love her anymore.
Jesus. My new fucking mantra.
He moved out that same night, and we were like, stuck, just the two of us, in this big townhouse off the French Quarter. My mom barely left her room for 3 months.
Jesus.
Yeah, she was... Well, I mean, seriously, don't tell anyone this. But she was even hospitalized. It was the doctors who thought we should move back here. At least in the city, she has some family, you know? You remember my aunt who lives in Marin?
Of course. Eliza's aunt is this cool old lesbian who works as a park ranger out at the Point Reyes National Seashore. Eliza's family took me on a few weekend trips up there when we were kids. I leaned back against the iron railing.
So who was she? Another bimbo waitress?
Eliza laughs.
No. She's actually a chef, too, if you can believe that.
I'd have thought with your dad's ego being like it is, that would be way too threatening.
She smiles. You remember that, too, huh?
I remember everything.
She stops smiling. I know, she says finally. Miles, I'm sorry.
And I say, No, that's not what I meant. But anyway, I'm sorry, too.
She's closer to me now, so I can hear the shallow sound of her breathing against the cold night air. I remember when we went to Hawaii together, back when we were kids. Her mom paid for this cool Hawaiian guy to take us horseback riding along the tops of these cliffs overlooking the ocean. But at one point, when our guide was busy closing the gate behind us, Eliza's horse took off running, and then, not even knowing what I was doing, I kicked my horse hard with my heels and went galloping after her. It was my first time ever being on horseback, but I had to catch her. So I got my horse right up beside hers, and somehow that made the horse she was on slow down and relax, until finally we were both able to stop. She was breathing fast then. I remember it, like she was hyperventilating, so bad she could barely even speak. Take a deep breath, I told her. Come on, you can do it. Just take a deep breath. And she did. She did what I told her. She breathed deep and long and slow. I listen to her breathing now. Slower, easier. I kick the toe of my boot into the ground, trying to think up something to say to change the subject. Did your, dad stay in New Orleans?
Yeah. And you know how my dad used to be so obsessed with Japan? Now it's like he's totally changed, and suddenly he doesn't care at all about the Japanese stuff, and he's become totally obsessed with New Orleans. I swear, he's gonna start talking with an accent before long. We both laugh at that. You know, he was always pretty distant, and he was terrible to your mom, and to you, really. So maybe you guys are better off this way?
That's exactly what I told my mom, she says. I knew you'd understand.
She takes my hand in hers for a second, and the feel of her is warm and electric all over my body.
Well, I tell her, I am sorry this is happening to you. I know it must be hard.
Yeah, thanks.
She tilts her head to one side. Anyway, she adds, at least we got to move back here, right?
I nod, thinking that maybe I really should make getting food a priority, because the nausea is not letting up. The pain is still in my stomach, and now the veins in my skull feel all swelled with blood, squeezing in at my temples so goddamn tight. With each beat of my heart, it's like the veins clamp down even harder, and I see this bright light flashing in the darkness when I close my eyes.
Hey, are you all right?
She asks me.
Yeah. No, I say, standing up as slowly as I can so I don't do anything embarrassing, like maybe pass out completely.
I'm fine. You wanna go get something to eat?
Sure, she says, smiling.
I can make something inside, I tell her, not wanting to make her leave if she doesn't want to. Or we could go to Video Cafe. They're open 24 hours. She nods.
Okay, yes. Let's do that.
Her body brushes against mine as she starts to walk, and I feel this warmth in me just from the slightest touch. That strange rotting smell is gone, and I think maybe this might actually work out. After all, she seems the same. I mean, different, but the same. The same Eliza. And I think maybe I'm not that different either. It's just like it used to be. But then Preston's front door opens and a bunch of kids holding 40s come pouring out into the courtyard with us. They're seniors I know only by sight, but tonight, because of Eliza being so goddamn beautiful, they seem eager to talk. In fact, one of them even knows my name.
Yo, what's up, Miles? Who's this you got here?
He's sloppy drunk, but still handsome, I think. At least, I imagine Eliza must think he's handsome. He has his hair all shaved around the sides and long in front, sticking up straight, kind of like a pompadour. His teeth are bright white in the darkness, and he smiles big and reaches out a hand to shake Eliza's.
Hey, I'm Kevin, he says.
She shakes his hand, and then the other guys all introduce themselves too. To her, not to me. Besides Kevin, I don't process any of their names enough to remember what they are. But then the one dude with a stupid hipster straw hat pulls out a blunt from behind his ear and asks us if we want any. Eliza presses in closer to me and kind of looks up for approval, as if somehow it's up to me. I guess because I was the one who wanted to leave so bad.
Yeah, go ahead, I say.
And she smiles and leans against me. And the guy fires the blunt up when it's like someone is driving nails into either side of my brain. And so I press the palm of my hand against my forehead. Eliza hits the blunt, and then she coughs real cute-sounding, and all the guys laugh. She hits it again before passing it off, and then standing up on her tiptoes and whispering in my ear,
Hey, you want to go to that restaurant now?
The two of us walk out through the iron gate and down the street past the wall of boxwood hedges surrounding the golf course. Beyond the protection of the courtyard, the wind is blowing even stronger, and I shiver.
Here, she says, handing my coat back to me.
I want to take it, but I feel like maybe she'll think I'm lame or something if I do.
No, it's okay, I say.
You keep it.
But the cold is all the way inside me now, and that headache has gotten so bad that it's like whatever had been pounding there before has now just clamped down, so I have to keep my eyes pretty near shut. I throw my cigarette out, but that doesn't help either.
and as much as I want to be hanging out with her, I'm suddenly wondering if maybe I should just go home and lie down. So I stop and I breathe, then I grit my teeth together, putting my hands on my knees and saying, "Hey, Eliza, look, I'm sorry. I want to hang out with you and get dinner and everything. I really do, and it's so great seeing you. But I have this terrible headache right now for some reason. I think maybe it's all the medicine." I force my eyes open enough to see her smile, and her teeth are white and straight and perfect. "Yeah, you look a little sick." I breathe, straining. "I'm so sorry, Liza." She nods. "No, I understand. I'll let you go. It's just so great to see you again. And look, Miles, I know I was terrible to you when we were younger. Really, I'm not sure why you put up with me like you did. But I am so, so sorry." "Please, no," I say, but hoarsely, so I have to clear my throat before continuing. "You don't need to apologize. I understand. Anyway, I wasn't putting up with you. I liked hanging out with you." She touches me just for a moment, and I feel it coursing through me again. The sound of the wind is like the ocean waves breaking through the treetops. The fog light at the mouth of the bay flashes across the dark silhouette of Eliza's body pressed close to mine. "I think I was just too afraid then," she tells me, looking straight ahead. I laugh through my nose. "Afraid of me?" "Yeah, totally. You always seemed so perfect or something. Like you had this perfect family and you were so good, so sweet, so perfect." I stare down suddenly, at the hole widening on the side of my boot where I can see black socks starting to stick out. "Yeah, well, not anymore. Now I'm just crazy." She looks up, and her eyes close and open, and she whispers, "I like you so much, Miles. I've always liked you." She lifts up on the balls of her feet, and suddenly she's pressing her full lips into mine, and she's kissing me. It's happening so fast, and I want to be able to just hold on to every fucking second. I mean, I've been waiting for this kiss with Eliza for my whole life. But now that it's actually happening, it's like I feel strangled somehow. We slide our tongues in and out, but the lack of oxygen to my brain is making the veins swell and pound and fucking press down even more. I feel dizzy, and something gags me at the back of my throat and I have to push her away. I drop to my knees, hitting the pavement hard as vomit comes charging up out of my throat. "Oh my God, what's happening?" she yells. I throw up over and over and over, retching, spitting up chunks of stringy I don't even know what, like pieces of shredded kelp and seaweed, all green and reddish purple. "Gah," is the noise I make, and then, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry," and then the vomit comes again. I lie with my face on the cold, rough concrete. I spit and punch the ground with my fist. "Just go away," I finally say. "I'm sorry. Please." Her voice comes out pretty hysterical sounding. "No, I'm not leaving you." But there's barf everywhere, and I'm so sick and disgusted with myself, I yell at her. "I want you to leave, all right? Just go away." She takes a step back. "Go!" I yell. I hear what sounds like her bursting into tears, and then her boots running away from me down the street. 15. Someone calls out from behind me and I turn, angry at first, just wanting to be left alone. "I'm all right," I groan, struggling to get to my feet. "Jesus Christ," the voice says. "What happened?" I turn to see Jackie, wearing a wool hat, gloves, and a big knit sweater, walking quickly toward me. "Nothing," I tell her. "I'm all right." She smiles and shivers and crosses her arms and says, "Brr, it's so fucking cold out here. Come back inside. We can hide out in Preston's room." The street lamp overhead switches on so that Jackie is silhouetted by the soft glow and the fog coming down. She reaches out to take my hand and I do not pull away. not from her.